This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:04 in the evening, and first things first, a conclusion of sorts to a story that broke late last year. So, entertainment outlets in Kuala Lumpur that are licensed to close in the early hours of the morning can continue to do so, and this is according to Federal Territories Minister Khalid Samad. Huzzah!
You gotta fight for your right to
So Khalid said the closing time for entertainment outlets in the city and its outskirts will remain unchanged following the ministry's meeting with Kuala Lumpur City Hall, DBKL, and KL lawmakers on Tuesday.
There are 672 entertainment outlets in Kuala Lumpur, of which 173 close between 3 and 5 a.m. and are situated in both the suburbs and certain outlying areas. And the remainder close, they close at 12, 1 or 2 a.m. depending on their category and their location.
Khalid said the DBKL will issue warning letters if businesses were found to be involved in drug abuse or prostitution. Repeat offenders will face premise closures or seizure of goods and equipment.
He also said that the ministry will attempt to persuade 233 businesses that are allowed to operate until 2 a.m. to close at 1 a.m. instead. A group representing over 100 entertainment outlets owners had urged Khalid and DBKL to reconsider the move after he announced that, you know, all entertainment outlets need to close by one.
So this is welcome news for night owls who prefer to socialise during the night. Here's a video that suggests some of us are actually genetically predisposed to stay up past our bedtime.
You may have heard the saying, the early bird gets the worm. But when it comes to humans, do morning people really have an advantage over night owls? Does one come out on top as more intelligent or successful than the other in this battle over bedtime? The somewhat surprising truth is that we have little say in sleep preference, as it's almost entirely genetically predetermined. Chances are, if you're a night owl, it was likely passed down from an ancestor who was also a night owl. And from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense. Having individuals with varying sleeping patterns would allow for better protection of a group throughout the day and night. Instead of everybody sleeping at one time, some people naturally stay up later and some wake up earlier, aware of threats or predators, while others sleep. But considering most modern societal activities happen between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m, it may seem clear that night owls are put at a disadvantage. And researchers have actually coined the term social jet lag to describe the sleep deprivation many experience to accommodate social norms. For night owls, this social jet lag feels like living in a different time zone every single day. Considering chronic sleep deprivation has a direct effect on brain functioning, it's no surprise that studies report night owl university students have lower overall grades. Not to mention, early birds tend to display more positive social traits, such as being proactive and optimistic, and are less prone to depression or addictions to nicotine, alcohol, and food. Your inner clock is regulated by many proteins which are created from various genes in your DNA. Studies have even shown that a single change of the genetic code near a gene called period 1 can result in an hour difference in your waking time. As crazy as it seems, scientists also found a correlation between these same genes and your time of death. The early risers were more likely to die around 11 a.m., while the night owls were more likely to die before 6 p.m. What about teenagers, you say? It's true, most tend to be night owls due to the hormonal changes during puberty, but this tends to wane out into your genetic default as you enter adulthood. So while there may be some truth to early birds getting the worm, night owls aren't exactly lagging behind in life, they're just lagging behind in time.
I have to say that as somebody who has been both a night owl as well as, what's the phrase, a morning bird? I don't know.
Early bird, right?
Early bird, thank you. Morning bird sounded odd. I couldn't figure out why. As somebody who has been both of those things in my lifetime, I'm glad to see. I do think that there needs to be some allowance for people, shift workers, as we said at the time, people who just want to see Kuala Lumpur be a little more alive, a little longer into the night. I think this is welcome news, at least for me. What do you think?
I welcome the news as well. I just wonder what the point was of the minister firstly announcing this move, because it seems like he was never going to actually do it.
No, I think he was pretty strong that he wanted to. Right. This seems to have happened after consultation with the people who it would actually affect. And I mean, we spoke yesterday and it sparked off, you know, quite a lot of conversation about the smoking ban. I think it was yesterday, about how businesses are complaining that it's seeing a dip in their revenue, it's seeing a dip in their profits. And I would imagine that with that happening for eateries, people might these are some people who might be affected by both of these, right? Both the smoking ban as well as the closing time. And I would imagine that that would be even more motivation to say, hey, please stop eating into our business.
So maybe the no smoking thing had a first mover's kind of advantage to these eateries, right? And then the circumstances that led to it maybe meant that Khalid couldn't really ask these outlets to close at 1 a.m. because, you know, it's going to hurt their business a lot more.
I think that's what it seems like. Are you glad to see the timing extended? What do you think? Or would you have preferred to see that 1 a.m. closure more strictly enforced? Let us know. That number to WhatsApp is 018-789-8899. You can also, of course, tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we're going to be taking a look at our next story, which is based on this announcement made quite a while back now by Education Minister Dr. Mazli Malik.
My vow to my own self and to UIA and to my country that I will bring back the glory of UIA and to make UIA the Oxford of Muslim countries. And I believe UIA staff, UIA professors, UIA students, they are with me, standing strong behind me.
So Dr. Mazli has been expressing this aspiration of his for some time now, and it was really one of the key factors expressed in why it had taken him so long to relinquish his position as the president of UIA, or the International Islamic University Malaysia.
Of course, as we know, the minister has since stepped down from that position in the university, but now a sociology professor at the National University of Singapore, Syed Farid Alatas, is asking the next president to reassess the idea of making the institution an Oxford for Muslim countries.
The reason he gave was that local institutions should, quote unquote, get over this business of wanting to emulate internationally recognized institutions, especially Western ones, just for the sake of it. He clarified that he was all for pushing the university towards high standards, but that it doesn't mean that we should model ourselves after Oxford, Harvard and the likes, because their education models may not be appropriate for us.
Farid also said that some universities abroad tend to marginalize non-Western voices and might teach Asian-related subjects such as Eastern religions from Eurocentric perspectives, pointing out that, of course, we would have our own lived perspectives that would change how these subjects can be taught. This is Azma Ismail, Vice Chancellor at University Science Malaysia, discussing this very topic at the World Academic Summit in 2018.
Because we followed the advice of Ahmad Zuel, the Nobel laureate. If you work on what the West is doing, you will be 20 years behind. But if you work on what the West is not interested in, you will be 20 years ahead. That, in essence, is Blue Ocean Strategy. And this is where we now focus our research, our innovation, to be able to help the people of the marginalized.
Now, going back to Farid, he also criticized what he called the capitalistic approach of Western universities, saying this had brought about an obsession with maintaining performance indicators and keeping or cancelling programs according to their popularity, even though one could argue why the program should remain, as well as the disease of wanting to go higher in rankings, and said it had infected many universities that follow Western models.
Finally, he went on to say that local universities need to work on ridding the Malay world of racial stereotyping, which he described as a legacy of European colonization. I, for one, welcome this statement. I do think that at a certain point, while saying things like, we're going to be the next Oxford, we're going to be the next, I don't know who's still saying this, Bill Gates, we're going to be the next, you know, whatever, there is a point where we realize that very often these comparison points are the highest of comparison points in the Western world, and that when we make attempts to emulate it, I don't know whether it really sets us up for greatness, simply because we are merely following in the footsteps and hoping to kind of retrace and get to the same point. And I think he made several rather excellent points, you know, part of which includes that note about programs being unpopular and therefore being cancelled. I don't necessarily think market forces should drive the situation in universities, where it's supposed to be a place of learning, where there might be value in things, even if there isn't like a money value attached to it.
And that has failed us in so many ways. We look at the oversupply of medical undergrads that we have today. We look at the oversupply and the low pay that some engineers, some lawyers might even be facing today, because, you know, the market responded to a need, the university market rather, responded to a need in the work or an employment market that they needed more of these people. So let's create a bunch of these courses. Let's sell them. Let's hype them up, and then have as many students join us as possible and look at where we are today.
The other thing that I want to point out is that when it comes to having your own perspective inform your curriculum or inform your the way your university or your college is run, I think it's so crucial simply because, for example, when I studied in Australia, not all the time, of course. I went to university in Australia, and that was when I learned about the history and the situation of the Aboriginal people living in Australia, you know, the Lost Generation, things like that. And it was then that I felt shamed that I didn't really know all that much about the about what's going on with Orang Asli and Orang Asal in my own country, right? And it is, of course, the university's right in Australia to ensure that everybody there is on the same page about their understanding of colonization, with their history, with their understanding of, you know, the importance of Indigenous land, for example. And we should have that same sort of perspective here rather than having it be purely doctrine, I think. Here we tend to work on a few principles, some of which are very kind of old-fashioned, I suppose, and we don't always adapt for modern Malaysian perspectives or historical Malaysian perspectives that I think would enrich probably courses in universities here.
You know, I think what was interesting for me was that at one time I was doing a series on the evening edition about languages. And when I spoke to some of these professors, what they thought was that, you know, white Westerners would be very open to sending their kids away to remote places in Malaysia, remote places in Indonesia to study indigenous languages because, well, you know, there's value there for them that they see. But when it comes to, you know, Malaysians wanting to send their own kids to these places and they wouldn't want to do so. And I think because of that, that partially leads us to having less control over the narratives that and the interesting stories and the interesting research we could possibly pursue. You know, we have a lot of indigenous languages here that is worth looking into, but a lot of times you'll find someone from Norway studying, like someone from the Max Planck Institute, as opposed to someone from UM, because, you know, there is either no interest or there's a lot of fear.
Sometimes there's resources, issue of resources as well,
true.
I think. Let us know what you think. Do you agree with the statement that we shouldn't be trying to make our universities the next Oxford? Instead, we should be adhering to our own Eastern values in terms of how we kind of decide what a value of a university is and where it should sit. You can watch WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Regarding the closing times, Sharil Fazli says, let them close whenever they want. It's their business, for God's sake. And then Shani says, DBKL Entertainment closing times. The CPTPP is already finalised, signed by Malaysia. If Malaysia is to ratify this, any changes to business operating hours would be covered under access to market and contravene that. All local authorities might not be aware of the implications in relation to free trade agreements such as the CPTPP. Keep those thoughts coming. Again, that number to WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we talk about whether Google might be replacing your doctor. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. Earlier, we were speaking about closing times and in Kuala Lumpur and how that's going to remain, well, at whatever it was that it was before. If you were closing at 2, you stick to 2. If you're closing from 3 to 5, you stick to that. We've been asking you what you think. We also spoke about a statement that was made by Syed Farid Alatas from the National University of Singapore, saying that basically, we should reassess the idea that we need to make the institution of the International Islamic University Malaysia an Oxford for Muslim countries, and that perhaps we should just get over this business of wanting to be westernized. Let us know your thoughts. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, for our next story. Google was never supposed to be the substitute for your doctor, but let's be real, we are all on WebMD.
Psychothymic disorder. Emotional ups and downs, hyperactivity, loss of interest and or pleasure, lack of sexual drive.
Okay, was I not clear about WebMD?
Thanks to a combination of Google, WebMD, there are many of us who haven't been to the doctor to talk about an illness in years. In fact, 1 in 20 Google searches are for health-related information. Dr. Google may not have an MD or a board certification, but it does have the clinical knowledge of a primary care provider who sees millions of patients a year. But how much should we trust Google with our health?
That's an interesting perspective, isn't it, to think of Google as a doctor that's seen so many people just saying, what is this? I have this. What's going on? So with so much interest, it might be surprising how tentatively tech-driven efforts have entered this $3.5 trillion US dollar healthcare industry. After 3 years, IBM's AI-driven Watson for Oncology not only delivered new insights on cancer treatments, but also, in some instances, even recommended unsafe and incorrect treatments. But in fairness to Dr. Watson, it was working with the same scant medical records that limit human physicians. Artificial intelligence predictive capacity comes not from superior processing power itself, but from using that power to discover signals in vast quantities of data.
Insights often arise in unexpected places. Some years ago, Target attracted attention for identifying a teenager's pregnancy before the girl had informed her father. Turns out you can learn a lot from a person shopping history. A customer doesn't need to do anything as obvious as buying diapers or maternity clothes. The store can make diagnosis based on subtle changes in shopping habits. Things like unscented lotions, vitamins, and flu medicine all serve as leading indicators of an expectant mother. And a person's shopping history is just one of millions of data points collected by ad platforms.
Ad networks like Google and Facebook track users all over the internet with cookies and device identifiers. They also, of course, work with data brokers, which aggregate personal data from public and private sources, and then sell access to their partners. These online databases assemble information collected from things like store loyalty cards, public voting records, salary and pay stubs, to form what you would say is a pretty comprehensive profile of every individual. I mean, whenever you go to a doctor, you do talk about your health background. More often than not, you do tell them what your family's history is, where you're at. They assess you based on that as well. But thinking about what Google can form of your profile is quite amazing, actually, because it knows so much about you and it's got a pretty holistic, well-rounded view of your life and your habits.
Yeah, and I think the problem here is also that all our medical records are not connected. So if you go to a new doctor that you don't usually frequent, you have to keep updating them about your medical records, and that's troublesome, actually.
Yeah, but not if you just keep Googling.
So as a result, tech companies know things that we would never admit to a doctor. Here's the kind of data out there that could paint a picture of someone's health, at least in America. Amazon would know what medication you buy to treat your chest infection, what sort of chemical sprays you buy for your gardening needs, and thanks to the company's acquisition of Whole Foods in the US, they would know whether or not you consume a lot of red meat.
I mean, it doesn't have to be America, right? If we look at ourselves and you just kind of think about it, Google has a history of every symptom you've ever typed into a search bar everywhere you've ever been, and it can successfully detect flu epidemics based on search queries. So if matched correctly, this data could help Google give better diagnoses. Say you enter a list of early symptoms of Ebola on the WebMD symptom checker, it might tell you that you have the stomach flu. But Google would know that you just went on a jungle trek in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and could prescribe something more serious than, say, a bottle of charcoal pills.
Google says its search engine app will make it easier to figure out what's causing your medical symptoms. In a blog post, the company said 1% of its searches are for medical symptoms, like headache. That means there are millions of searches for medical information on Google already. Now, when someone searches for a symptom on the Google app in the US, they will be given a description of the problem along with some self-treatment options, if there are any. Google will also suggest when people should consult a doctor. A 2013 Pew survey found 1 in 3 Americans have gone online for information on a medical condition they or others have, and information found online isn't always accurate. One study found that symptom checkers online only provide the correct first diagnosis a third of the time. Google says it carefully reviewed the symptom information on its app with doctors. Experts from the Harvard Medical School and Mayo Clinic evaluated a sample of the related conditions. Google intends for the feature to be used for informational purposes only and says you should always consult a doctor for medical advice.
So I'm utterly guilty of this, right? Of Googling what I think might be symptoms and trying to kind of glom together a diagnosis of sorts. And part of it comes from a general aversion to seeing the doctor. I don't think I'm alone there, but it's one that I've gotten over. Having said that, I also think it's a time-saving measure half the time. You just want to know, do I need to go see a doctor? Is this something that I need to actually take the time out, go somewhere, maybe take half a day off work? And so sometimes it's just easier and faster to Google.
And also cost-saving, actually, because if you just realize that perhaps you just need to see the pharmacist for certain pills. That's what I usually do when I have a cold or flu.
That's a very Malaysian thing, though, because we view our pharmacists as sort of second in line to doctors. It's almost a doctor replacement. It feels like people treat them that way for things that they consider, you know, not so serious. But I think, like what you said earlier about having to kind of transpose your medical history when you move from doctor to doctor, it's made much worse, right, when you don't go to the doctor actually for everything that you've needed, right? When you've kind of dispersed your medical information to a bunch of different places. Maybe you told your friend, maybe you told the pharmacist, maybe you told your colleagues who offered you Panadol. So there are different people who remember different days when you might have had a headache or when you might have had a stomach ache. And sometimes I would imagine that that can lead to people missing things out, like missing how it might have formed a pattern, a symptomatic pattern. I don't know. I'm certainly not recommending this whole Googling for health thing, but or at least not Googling for diagnosis.
I also generally wonder how doctors usually will respond when a patient comes in with, hey, I just searched on Google, do I have this, this, this? So I've been told off by my doctor once for doing that, because my doctor, she said to me, nope, stop saying it in very technical terms, just tell me where it hurts and just tell me how it feels.
I think different doctors, from what I understand, different doctors have different perspectives. Some, I think, quite like speaking to an informed patient, but I think a little information can be a dangerous thing if it's being wielded by somebody who really has kind of no medical context. But I'm pretty sure that we're not alone in this in terms of like Googling our medical symptoms, Googling our medical history. Let us know if you do that. Have you ever kind of used Google as a replacement for going to your GP? How did that turn out? WhatsApp us and let us know. 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got this message here from Kuhan Chandru about that earlier note about whether or not Malaysia needs to kind of create the next Oxford University. And he says, for research, science and technology, Malaysia doesn't have a research history like most of the Western world that can be emulated. But for social sciences, we have to hold on to our ways and our culture. I agree with that. And I think there's a reason why that statement that we're referring to came from a professor of sociology.
Yeah.
Again, that number to WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. And you can, of course, tweet us at BFM Radio. Right now, we've got Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. I Need to Know, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Now, much earlier in the show, although it's one that's kind of run throughout, we were talking about Google and how an article from Tech Insider posited that if Google were a doctor, that Google would have the most information out of any doctor ever, because people are always Googling their symptoms. People are always asking Google what's up with them. And we kind of spun that out to talk about diagnoses and whether or not Google has ended up sometimes replacing your GP.
Yeah, and you know, we got a message from Dr. Gill earlier saying that these patients that come in with Google-esque results come kind of disappoint him.
Yeah, actually, two healthcare workers, one Dr. Gill, someone else who wanted to be anonymous, basically said the same thing, that it's not always a helpful thing. But, you know, it's not for us to say. It's actually for others to say. And so for that, our interns, again, armed with their trusty recorder, hit the streets and asked people for their thoughts.
When you're ill, do you turn to Google first or straight to the doctor?
When I'm ill, I think I will usually go to my mom first. Or my friends, or my boyfriend. Then if there's no one to ask, then I go to Google. I think I trust my mom, my boyfriend, and friends more than Google, I guess. They know my health condition better.
Google my symptoms, and then I'll find out if there's any home remedy.
I think Google, but after that, I'll probably ask my parents, then the doctor after that. Because I think our parents are always somewhat of a doctor, or they probably have some experience of like what's going on with my body before the doctor, because the doctor charges and my parents don't.
It's more likely that I would turn to Google first to look up the symptoms, mainly because it's at your fingertips, it's accessible, and you would want to see whether there's some sort of remedy for it firsthand, you know, before actually going to seek medical attention at a facility like that. Yeah.
How often has your Google diagnosis been right?
Maybe about 3 to 4 out of 5 times, because mainly that is my first point that I approach to.
I don't know, because I'm not a doctor.
I think Google diagnoses are pretty accurate if you actually know what the symptoms, it's not just what the symptoms, what is it, like the specific name of the problem that you have. But if you just Google like heart pain, coughing, blood, you know, and definitely then something's going to come out like really bad.
Oh my, this is the very funny topic. I go with my friends before, like, you know what happened when you Google your sickness on Google? You feel like you're going to die soon, like, oh, you got cancer, actually. So I would say it's 100% accurate, actually. Most of the time, it just give you a heart attack.
Does Google sometimes replace your doctor, and do you feel safe doing so?
I don't think Google will ever replace the doctor because doctor is diagnosed specifically and tailored to you face-to-face kind of thing. But in terms of Google, I think it's, once again, I think if you know specifically what is it and if you just want to buy certain medicine or like home remedies kind of thing, to be much more efficient, because if you go to the doctor probably tell you the same thing and probably charge you a fee, but Google in a sense is free.
Not really. I think what Google really helps you is just to give you a precaution of what you might be having. Then it's actually your own duty to go to the doctor or anyone else to find out whether you're really that sick or not.
Well, of course, you'd always want to search for medical attention from the medical expert. So there's only so much that you can trust when it comes to Google. Of course, that being said, it's always advisable to try and seek, you know, professional medical advice. I do have friends who are doctors themselves, so that does make it easier as well for me to approach them instead of actually visiting a hospital or a medical facility.
Not really. Most of the time, I'll basically conduct the home remedy as one of the first options. Then, if it is still not healing, then I may reach out to the doctor.
What do you do to verify the information that you find on Google?
Oh, that's when I go back to mom and doctor again. Anyone that I more trust, then I'll get checked again. But I think the final decision, by right, you should go to the doctors.
It is only natural that you go to a number of sites, links, just to confirm that, yes, you know, this is the same answer that you're getting. Forums do help people who do have similar issues that you are going through. It's good to get some sort of verification from there as well, you know, so that you feel as though you're not alone on this, whatever you may be facing.
I'll just try the remedies. Yeah, I prefer the natural healing rather than medicine.
I'll normally ask my friends who are pharmacists or friends who are doctors, yeah, to verify whether does this make sense. Like, I'm having these symptoms, Google telling me that this is what's happening, it recommends me to buy this medicine or this, do this kind of thing. Does it make sense?
Do you depend on any technology to help monitor or regulate your health?
I have my iWatch, so just to monitor my calories, that's it. I think the blood pressure is not really my concern because I always have low blood.
I do have a heart rate machine at home. That's something that I use. You know, I myself have a watch that you can consider is like a smartwatch, you know, that tracks my calories, my heart rate and all that. So in this era, I do turn to technology, you know, to help me with my health and such as well.
No, I'm quite skeptical, I guess. I'm not too sure whether those things, is it just a placebo? Whether does it work or not? It's like, I mean, if you work out, you go to the gym, you watch out your diet, I think those are more efficient than tracking how many steps you walk.
Not really. I guess a normal person, if you want to regulate your health or just be mindful of what you eat, diet, exercise, I think that's the most typical thing if you want to stay healthy. Not about whether technology can help you or not. Because pretty much your own body. You have to run, you have to walk it, you have to sleep enough, eat well. I think that's the basic of the basic. Technology cannot help this.
Well, gosh, my big takeaway from that is people rely on their parents. We talked about doctors, pharmacists and Google, but we did not address the parent factor.
I'm quite surprised that a lot of people go to, well, based on that small survey, that they go to their parents for confirmation of what they're sick with.
I think it's because your parents were probably the people who told you when you were young that you were sick. Mm. If you felt unwell, that was the hand. I mean, if you grew up with your parents, then that would be the hand that touched your forehead, right? That would be those would be the people that would be like, oh, let's get the fever strip out. So I suppose there's that habit built in from a very young age to go ask your parents, hey, I have this, what do you think it is? But yeah, just an additional factor that I hadn't considered.
Are you inclined to trust your parents? I don't trust my parents about my illness. Okay, I admit that I do go to Google, but once I feel like I'm not getting better, I do still go to the doctor. I think parents are like the last place I would go to.
I have a slightly embarrassing admission to make, which is that I often tell my family and sometimes my close friends and my partner weird symptoms that I'm encountering just in case I ever find myself in a house-esque medical case and I can't speak. And they ask, when did she first experience this? And they'll be able to tell. So in that sense, I don't know if that's me trusting texting my parents or just kind of being a TV-based hypochondriac. I'm not certain. Let us know, though. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Has Google replaced your doctor? Have your parents replaced your doctor? Do you share my irrational house-based fear? Let us know. And in the meantime, we've got some music coming your way. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.